Australia's poised to get its first federal female Muslim MP. But in a world where Islam is sometimes the object of mass fear, how brave was it for her to stand for Parliament? Hello, I'm Andrew West. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. The counter-terrorism expert Anne Ali reveals the challenge of being a breakthrough Labour candidate.
When they first asked me to run, I kind of looked at them both, like looked at them in this room, and I said, "You know who I am, right?" And they said, "Yes." I said, "You've heard about me, right?" And they said, "Yes." I said, "And you still want me to run, right?" And they're like, "Yes, we do."
That's coming up. And is religious violence a myth? The writer William Kavanagh says yes. South Australia's Nick Xenophon could hold the balance of power in the Senate following the federal election. His party's MP in the lower house may well prop up a minority Turnbull government. The issue that drove Senator Xenophon into politics is Australia's gambling crisis. Almost two-thirds of the gambling dollar goes into poker machines. Predatory gambling aimed at addicts costs Australia $4.7 billion a year. But gambling interests donate to sympathetic politicians and campaign against critics. So there's caution among those seeking reform. Dr. Mark Zernzak heads the Victorian Interchurches Gambling Task Force. He hopes Senator Xenophon can rein in the pervasive online betting business.
Yeah, look, it is the sports betting, horse racing, yes, gambling on politics. So what they term wagering is sort of the term that's used for that area, and that's the one where currently federal legislation allows for it to be offered in Australia, but there's a need to tighten up. I mean, what we've seen is very aggressive marketing activities, and we've also seen very aggressive and predatory use of credit by a number of these online wagering companies operating out of Australia.
And Mark, when you talk about the sort of predatory nature of online gambling, I mean, what are we talking about here? What's the size of the problem?
Well, the kind of things that were exposed, the Financial Counsellors of Australia did a report last year looking at the marketing activities of some of these online gambling companies, and what they found were, particularly for people who were losing a lot of money, some of these companies would assign them customer relations managers to basically coax them into losing as much as possible, even when they were indicating they were deeply in debt already and had lost their money. They were offered credit further in that. So you'd have things like this customer relations manager might ring up and say, "I've got a couple of tickets for a major sporting event, you know, maybe the grand final, and would you like to come to our corporate box?" And then they'd be given a couple of $100 to lose as opening credit to encourage them to bet their own money and lose more of that. And, you know, as a result, you had people with massive debts, lost their businesses, lost their homes, lost their marriages out of these kind of very predatory marketing activities.
The other area, of course, that has particularly animated the gambling debate is the question of poker machines. This was, for Senator Xenophon, I know for the Victorian churches and other churches around the country, a major issue, and that was poker machines. Senator Xenophon says he will still press ahead with new legislation to overhaul poker machines. He wants a maximum $1 bet per spin and $120 an hour maximum losses on the poker machines. That's compared with $1,200 an hour that is currently on the table. Do you sense any prospect of reform here?
Look, I mean, the things Senator Xenophon is putting forward, very worthwhile measures that would reduce harm. I think the problem we had, and many of us remember, the situation under the Gillard government, where Andrew Wilkie cut a deal with Julia Gillard over pokies reform, and the problem we have is that Clubs New South Wales has enormous influence over New South Wales politics, and that really needs to be countered with communities at the local level in New South Wales. You know, we had clubs in New South Wales pouring in vast sums of money. They were given a huge tax break just around the time of the Gillard-Wilkie deal, so they had a lot of money to spend, and tax breaks continued. And they will bus their club members around. They can afford to have coasters attacking the local candidate, big cardboard cutouts in their clubs attacking the local candidate. If there's any suggestion of any sort of reform that's going to reduce harm, you know, that does need to be countered by community groups who are concerned about pokies. And they certainly exist, but at the moment they're not mobilised in New South Wales. So clubs in New South Wales tends to get their way. Plus, they back that up with very substantial political donations, both to individual candidates and the major parties.
And just finally, Mark, Senator Xenophon has also spoken about this issue that seems to annoy an awful lot of sports fans, an awful lot of sports viewers, and that is odds being shown during sports games, sort of play-by-play betting, as it were. Is there potential to change this now?
Oh, look, I certainly would hope so. I mean, the one thing, the announcement for reforms of the online gambling just prior to the election were largely dealing with credit and also banning in-play betting. That's where you can sort of bet ball by ball or point by point in a match. But the advertising is the stuff that drives most Australians crazy. It just, people hate it. It interferes with the game. They don't like the way it's making kids think that gambling and sport are somehow connected when they're clearly not. I would hope that Senator Xenophon would have significant influence in helping the major parties move on getting a ban on advertising, or at least some greater restrictions on all this gambling advertising. I think most of us would just prefer not to see it there, but we'll have to wait and see what happens. But I certainly think the possibilities are there, and it is the one area where Australians really want to see reform happen.
Dr. Mark Czernzak of the Victorian Interchurches Gambling Task Force, and you're with Andrew West. In the West Australian seat of Cowan, Labor is optimistic its candidate, the international counter-terrorism expert Anne Ali, will prevail. As of Wednesday evening, Dr. Ali was about 700 votes ahead of the sitting Liberal MP. If elected, Dr. Ali will be Australia's first federal female Muslim MP. During the election, she was attacked by senior Liberals, including the Justice Minister Michael Keenan. But Dr. Ali says she stared down what she called a coalition smear campaign.
Well, I think it started out with Minister Keenan coming out and questioning a letter that I had written to a court with regards to a case involving two young men, one of whom is well known as a radical preacher. And he called it a letter of support, which it certainly wasn't. And had he read the letter, he would have known that, though I'm not quite sure that that would have mattered. You know, the letter was a letter simply detailing a conversation that I'd had where it was suggested that one of the men in particular, the one who wasn't the radical preacher, may well be fit for a de-radicalisation program that is very much in line with what the government proposes and is funded by the government. There was no real substance to the suggestion that I had supported a radical preacher at all. It was simply a throwaway line to try and, I guess, throw some dirt.
I've read where there was even a whispering campaign, it never quite made it into the newspapers, trying to position you as being sympathetic to the ultra-radical group Hizb Tahrir.
Yeah, I heard that too. Look, I had people calling me and saying, you know, there's a whispering campaign out there with they're trying to find something on you. I said, let them go. They won't find anything. You know, I talk a lot, Andrew, but I always remember what I said because I speak from a position of knowledge and experience. I don't speak from a position of ignorance. Everything that I say in this space is based on my research and it's based on evidence.
Well, you spoke at the White House, of course, at an international de-radicalisation summit.
Yeah, and you know, I've spoken at many international forums as well as national forums. I was nominated for Australian of the Year. I've won several awards and accolades for my work. So if there's one thing that I'm really proud of in my life, it's my work. So I was really quite confident that there was nothing there for them.
Did you get blowback on the streets, though, of Cowan? Were you getting aggressive questions from constituents as you campaigned?
Not at all. In fact, what I got was with the people that I met, whether I was phoning them or meeting them at the doorsteps, and even people phoning in to me and saying, look, I've been a Liberal supporter all my life, but the way that they treated you has just moved me and I'm going to be voting for you now. And that was the general response that I got from people who had heard of it. Some people rang me and said, look, I've heard this. I really want to question you about your stance on border security or your stance on that. And you know, once they heard my stance and they understood that I was coming coming from a position of experience and some expertise and knowledge, they turned around and said, well, that's it, I'm voting for you, you've convinced me.
I understand at one point in the campaign, a survivor of the Lindt Cafe siege, Louise Hope, actually wrote a letter in support of you. I'm wondering, therefore, whether there was a fear that some of the smear campaign was going to take hold.
Look, we always knew that they were going to try something. And sadly, it was not unexpected. Sadly, we knew that they were going to try something. I've worked with many victims of terror attacks. It's a core part of what I do, from the Omar Victims Survivors Group in Ireland through to 9/11 survivors, through to survivors in Bali and survivors in London. It's a core part of what I do. It sure did, I believe, you know, shore up some support, but it just shows the breadth of the work that I do.
Yes, what did Louise Hope, as I say, a survivor of the Lindt Cafe siege, when Man Haron Monis held the cafe, you know, under siege for all those hours, what did she write about you?
She just said that, you know, when that happened to her, that she reached out to me, which she did, that I flew over to Sydney to meet with her. And, you know, we had a discussion and she felt safe and secure. That's generally what I do when I go out and work with people who have survived terrorist attacks.
Now, Anne, you did not seek to make an issue of your Muslim background. Did others?
Some people did, and I think, you know, I can't help how I'm going to be labelled. A lot of, you know, the media headlines were, you know, referred to me as a Muslim academic or, you know, the Muslim candidate, and that's okay. That's part of who I am, but I'm also so much more than that as well. You know, I'm a mother, I'm a sister, I'm a daughter, I'm a wife. I've worked with communities, with schools, with governments, with international organisations and local organisations. I'm an author. I'm a coffee drinker. I'm an average cook and an avid gardener. Yeah. So there's so much more to me.
But you did say in a profile in the Sydney Morning Herald at the beginning of this year that you were, quote, more of a secular Muslim. Did you sense in saying that, that people would seek to make adverse impressions of your religion? Were you concerned about that? Is that why you emphasised that you were secular?
No, not at all. I was just being truthful. I am a secular Muslim. I do believe in the separation of religion and politics, and that's what a secular Muslim or a secular in any form of religion is. And I hold very dear our values, our secular values, and particularly our constitution, which, you know, under section 116 states that there is a separation of religion and the state. And it was just really a statement of who I am. My identity as a Muslim is as a secular Muslim.
Given that there is sometimes alarm in the community about certain expressions of Islam, I mean, that was the reason that you first came on this program a few years ago. Do you now think, Anne, that it was quite, in a way, brave of the Labor Party to endorse you?
Look, that's a good question, actually. When they first asked me to run, I kind of looked at them both, like looked at them in this room, and I said, you know who I am, right? And they said, yes. I said, you've heard about me, right? And they said, yes. I said, and you still want me to run, right? And they're like, yes, we do. I think it's brave that the Labor Party goes places where representing the diversity of our Australian community, I think, is really important. Yeah, I guess it is brave, but I wish we could see more of it.
Do you get criticism from some conservative sections of the Muslim community for not wearing a headscarf, for example?
Oh, absolutely. Of course I do. I get that. I get criticism from everywhere. I've had to get quite a thick skin. I also get some from the extreme right wing who you know, question, why aren't you wearing, why aren't you covering your face and covering your head? And I'm like, well, why don't you go and have a picnic with the conservative, you know, right wing Muslims, because you all think the same way. Yeah, I get that. But, you know, I'm big believer that it's a choice and a woman's choice to wear what she wants to wear. I don't think that in the year 2016 we should be talking about what women wear. I think we're past that and we're over that, and those discussions really don't need to be had.
Counter-terrorism expert Dr. Anne Alley, who could win the West Australian seat of Cowan for Labor. And this is the Religion and Ethics Report. Well, as Islamic extremists explode bombs and spray bullets across Baghdad and Bangladesh, Turkey and Saudi Arabia, it's surely impossible to deny the reality of religious violence. But William Kavanagh of DePaul University in the United States disputes the idea. His acclaimed book, The Myth of Religious Violence, argues that violence in the name of faith is no greater and may even be less than violence in the name of secular ideologies. Bill Kavanagh is in Australia this month to speak at the Australian Catholic University and the Centre for Public Christianity in Australia. How does he explain this latest carnage if it isn't religious?
Well, I think you always need to look at these things on a kind of case-by-case empirical basis. And clearly there's a case to be made that there is a virulent strain of Islam that's out there now that lends itself to violence. I don't think there's any question. But the question then becomes, does that mean that there is something called religion in general, which is always inherently dangerous? And is it more violent than so-called secular ideologies and institutions? We tend to ignore the violence done when it's done in the name of secular nation states, for example, when bombs are dropped from airplanes. But when bombs are detonated in backpacks, then we tend to regard that with a particular kind of abhorrence.
I guess I'm asking, though, isn't there a risk here, Bill, and I'm not necessarily pointing at you, but isn't there a risk that these whole debates can devolve into sort of relativism? I mean, Mennonites and Methodists and the United Church of Christ won't cut your head off today, but some Salafis and Wahhabis will.
Right. Oh, there's no question about that. I mean, it's very clear that there are certain strains of Islam today that do have a tendency to lend themselves to violence, but I think you also need to look at some of the causes. We have a tendency to look at Iran, for example, and see it as just this kind of eruption of Islamic craziness in the year 1979, and we tend to ignore the secularist regime of the Shah, which had ruled for the previous 26 years and had murdered thousands of people and tortured thousands of people and so on. And so we tend to prefer to see religion as this kind of sui generis kind of fomenter of violence, that people just had this crazy religious experience and they became fanatics and started killing people. And we tend to not look at it in the context of what I would call secularist violence, which in the case of Iran is very clear to see. So everybody remembers that the Ayatollah Khomeini instituted an Islamic dress code in 1979. Everybody forgets that the first Shah instituted a secularist dress code in 1924.
Let's go back to the central argument. I mean, what's the biggest myth about religious violence that you make in your book?
I think that if you look at the 20th century, if you ask the question, for example, who killed more people over the last 100 years, Muslims or atheists? The answer is atheists, and it's not even close. The biggest myth is that there is this kind of inherent craziness in so-called religious ideologies that's not there in atheist or non-religious or secular kinds of ideologies.
Yeah, well, let's...
And I just don't think you can generalize.
Let's do the sums in a sort of at least very elementary way. Those atheist ideologies, what were they and how many did they kill?
Well, estimates of how many people were killed under Marxist regimes range as high as 110 million. And that tends to be concentrated in under Stalin, Mao, and Lenin, and then included the North Korean regimes as well.
Yeah, Pol Pot in Cambodia.
Pol Pot, yeah, that's right.
How do critics of religion rationalize the point that you've made?
What Christopher Hitchens does, for example, in his book God is Not Great, he takes that evidence and he simply declares that all of those atheist ideologies are religious too, because he says that totalitarianism is inherently religious, and therefore he just kind of neatly turns those kind of atheist ideologies into religions. For Hitchens, basically, the religious-secular distinction is nothing more than the distinction between things Hitchens likes and things that Hitchens doesn't like. What counts as religious and what counts as secular is very malleable, and it kind of depends on what people want to indict and what they want to excuse.
I mean, the flip side, of course, of the point that you make was that Hitchens was all too willing to claim Martin Luther King, who said repeatedly that he was a Christian minister, as merely a secular leader, I think, at one point.
Right. He says that in no sense was Martin Luther King a Christian. And he bases that remarkable conclusion on the fact that Martin Luther King was nonviolent, and therefore he couldn't have been religious because religion is violent. And Hitchens himself, of course, was a cheerleader for the Iraq War, but that's not really considered violence because it's secular.
I take your point, Bill, but I'm thinking, though, of conflicts, for example, in parts of Africa, where the conflict at its core may be over a resource as basic as water, but it is inflamed with religious rhetoric to turn a resource war into something more meaningful.
I think that's something that needs to be clear, is that I'm not one of the people who will argue that the causes are really political and not really religious, or really economic and not really religious. The point, however, is that there isn't something called religion which is inherently different than so-called political and economic kinds of ideologies and justifications for violence. What I am saying is that we need to have a level playing field between, say, nationalism on the one hand and Islam on the other hand, and say that these are not two essentially different kinds of justification for violence. They're really essentially similar kinds of justifications for violence.
Yes, one comment that you made in your book leapt out at me, where you said that basically critics of religion define anything that you take seriously as religion, even if it has nothing to do with the divinity or the supernatural or a holy text.
Right. And there are some people that, of course, want to expand the definition of religion to include things like nationalism and Marxism and so on. And I think they're right about that. I mean, there's a certain kind of insight that comes from Durkheim there, which sees that these things are not essentially different kinds of things, but they're essentially similar kinds of things.
Let's reach back briefly into history, because you give a very good example. Why weren't the wars of religion fought in the Reformation era in Europe actually religious?
I mean, the first thing that should raise suspicions is the fact that Catholics killed Catholics and Protestants killed Protestants, and Catholics and Protestants collaborated in enormous numbers in the so-called wars of religion. So this should raise some suspicions that this is not as simple as the tale is usually told. The 30 Years' War, which is usually held up as the kind of bloody poster child for this idea of the wars of religion, the second half of the war was essentially a war between the two great Catholic dynasties of Europe, the Habsburgs and the Bourbons. Cardinal Richelieu intervened on behalf of the Lutheran Swedes. And so this then begins to raise questions about whether or not you can call these wars of religion. The other thing, though, even deeper than that objection, is the fact that at the time you don't really have a distinction between religion and politics. This is a kind of modern invention that in some ways is an invention that results from the wars themselves. And it's a very complicated story, but to make things kind of simple, what you have is a battle between civil authorities and church authorities, which goes on for centuries and which is finally won in the early modern period by the civil authorities. And in order to marginalize the ecclesiastical authorities, they basically invent this category of religion, which then becomes something that is privatized. So the church now has responsibility for religion and the state has responsibility for politics. But this was a result of the war rather than a cause for the war. And so the wars in many ways of the 16th and 17th centuries, as Jose Casanova has said, these are really best called the wars of early modern state formation and not so-called religious wars.
Here on the Religion and Ethics Report with Andrew West, I'm speaking with William Kavanagh. He's a professor at DePaul University, one of the world's leading authorities on religion. And his book is The Myth of Religious Violence. And Bill will be in Australia to speak at a major conference on the subject held by the Australian Catholic University. Bill, where else in history, especially recent history, have we mislabeled or mistaken wars of religion?
We look at the violence in the Middle East and we want to attribute it to religion. That a lot of the stuff you read about it makes it seem as if Muslims were just reading their holy books in a different way and suddenly became radicalized and fanatical about this and then began beheading people and so on. But of course, you can't understand the revival or the creation of Muslim fanaticism in the Middle East without looking at the history of Western interventions in the Middle East over the course of the 19th and 20th centuries. I use the example of Iran before, where we like to just talk about this kind of crazy Shiite revival that happens with the Islamic Revolution in 1979, but we like to ignore the U.S. and British-sponsored coup in 1953, which overthrew a democratically elected president, Mohammad Mossadegh, and replaced him with a kind of brutal dictator, the Shah, who then ruled with a kind of secularist violence over the next three decades.
Yes, and indeed the pact that the West made after World War One with the House of Saud, with the Wahhabi-inspired House of Saud, that has exported a lot of this extremism.
That's right. I mean, more recently, of course, it's been said with a considerable degree of justification that ISIS is an American creation. This was not something that would have happened had the Iraq invasion not happened in 2003.
Yes, I mean, we should clarify, you don't mean an American creation cooked up in the back room of the CIA or the State Department. I'm assuming you mean an unintended creation, a creation of consequences of the Iraq war.
Right, of course. I thank you for that clarification. I don't mean to sound like an extremist, I suppose, on these questions. But the point is that you can't understand the violence of Islamic actors in the Middle East without understanding the violence of secular actors in the Middle East. There are annual conferences between Western diplomats and leaders from the Islamic world in Doha. And there was one a few years ago which followed the Iraq invasion, and it was at a time when there was Shiite versus Sunni violence in Iraq. And an American diplomat stood up and said, you know, we are not going to stand by and allow someone to impose their will on Iraq through means of violence. And I read about this in an article by Rami Khoury, who's a Middle Eastern journalist, who remarked, you know, did the Americans not use weapons when they invaded Iraq? I mean, it's the idea that only Shiite and Sunni violence actually counts as violence, and the 200,000 dead from the American invasion just doesn't count as violence at all. Our violence is not really violence. It's peacemaking and secular and rational, and their violence is real violence. It's crazy and irrational and so on.
Professor William Kavanagh of DePaul University is a leading expert on religion and conflict. His book is The Myth of Religious Violence, and Bill Kavanagh will be in Australia in July to address a major conference at the Australian Catholic University. Bill, thank you very much for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Oh, thank you, Andrew. It's been a pleasure.
And there's links to Bill Kavanagh's talks at our homepage at the RN website, where you can download and share our stories. Thanks to producer Nadia El-Ghouli and technical producer Joe Wallace. I'm Andrew West. Back next week.